welcome to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, August 20th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, John Deere Reports Earnings of Nearly $3 Billion in Third Quarter. Deere & Company reported a net income of $2.978 billion for the third quarter of 2023, the company announced Friday. Reported net income was $1.884 billion in quarter three of 2022. For the first 9 months of the year, the income attributable to Deere & Company was $7.797 billion, compared with $4.885 billion from the same period last year. Worldwide net sales and revenues increased 12% to $15.8 billion, for the third quarter of 2023 and rose 24% to $45.8 billion for 9 months. Net sales were $14.28 billion for the quarter and $41.8 billion for 9 months, compared with $13 billion and $33.6 billion last year. Reflected by our strong third quarter results, Deere continues to benefit from favorable market conditions and the operating environment showing further improvement, said John C. May, chairman and CEO. We are also being helped by stabilizing conditions in the supply chain, the sound execution of our business plan, and an improving ability to meet demand for our products and serve customers. Net income attributable to Deere & Company for fiscal 2023 is forecast to be in the range of $9.75 billion to $10 billion. Deere is well on its way to yet another year of exceptional achievement, due in large part to positive fundamentals in the farm and construction sectors and the unwavering commitment of the Deere team, including our dealers and suppliers, May said. Fundamentals are expected to continue fueling solid demand for our equipment, supported by a strong advance order position. At the same time, through the company's smart industrial operating model, we are delivering differentiated value to our customers, enabling them to do their jobs more profitably and sustainably. Now on to another article. Odds wane for people still missing after the blaze. Loved ones forced to face grim prospects while still holding on to some hope. The days of waiting have become harder and harder as the odds grow longer and longer. But Kevin Backlig remains undeterred in his search for his wife and her parents, missing since August 8th when a wildfire engulfed and flattened Hawaiian town Lahaina. Backlig, 30, has driven back and forth to Lahaina, desperately scouting for anything that might lead him to his wife, Angelica, and her parents, Joel and Adele Villagas. He's gone looking from one shelter to another, hoping strangers might recognize the faces on flyers he brings with them. I'm not going to give up until I see them, he said. Of course, I'm hoping to find them alive. What else can I do? Even as he tries to sound optimistic, Backlig's voice is subdued. I've been searching and searching, and Lahaina everywhere. He said, speaking in Ilocano, a dialect of the northern Philippines, six other relatives who live next door also remain unaccounted for. The blaze took scores of lives and destroyed hundreds of homes, including the house of Balakig's family, bought 3 years ago on Copley Street. About a 15-minute walk to the historic Front Street, once a bustling tourist center, but now a bleak avenue of flattened buildings lined with charred vehicles. The remains of 114 people have been found, most of them yet to be identified. Hawaii Governor Josh Green said the death toll will likely rise in the days to come as the painstaking search for remains continues in the heaps of rubble and ash in Lahaina, a seaside community of 12,000 and a tourist hotspot on Maui. Officials acknowledge that they don't have a firm number on the missing. Many initially listed and as unaccounted for have since been located. Earlier this past week, Police Chief John Pelletier said authorities would do their best to track down the missing, but I can't promise we're going to get them all, he said. The day before the fire, Po'omakia E. Estorlasano, a 28-year-old father of two, wished aloha to his ohana, the Hawaiian word for family. Another beautiful day in Hawaii, he wrote on Facebook, ending his post, urging his circle to have fun and enjoy, and never be unhappy and grumpy. He was among the scores still missing Saturday. His family has scoured the island, looking for him, checking hospitals and shelters. Without a car, Estores Lozano would have had to outrun the fire and smoke. "We don't want him to think we stop looking for him," said Kuule Barut, who last spoke to her brother the day before he went missing. His mother, Leona Castillo, wants to hang on to the possibility that her son is still alive, but she knows she may have to face the reality that she's not yet ready to accept. As talks of body count intensified, she got herself swabbed for DNA. She wants him to be found no matter how and where. "We don't want him to be lost," she said. "If we don't get his body back, he'll just be lost." In the days after the fire, there was chaos and confusion, with so many families looking for missing loved ones. Castillo said that she was relieved for friends and neighbors who were reunited with loved ones. But she wondered when it would be her turn. "I just want closure," she said. Ace Yabs is also waiting for a word from about his relatives. 9 in all who are all missing, including Angelica Basilig, whose family lived next door to an aunt and her family, 5 of whom have yet to be found. Kevin Basilig was at work as a nurse at a skilled nursing facility when the fire raced down from the hills and into the town, igniting nearly everything in its path. "I've been searching all the shelters, hotels, possible places they might go. I've gone to all of them. I've gone to the houses of their friends," he said. "I've reported them missing to the MPD, the Maui Police Department, and to the FBI. I've been showing their pictures." Baklig, who is staying with friends in Kahalui, on the northern flank of the island, holds out hope as he searches. Maybe in their haste to flee, none of them had time to grab their cell phones, which might explain why Basilig has yet to get a call. Maybe they are looking for him too, and unsure about his whereabouts. Amid anguish and uncertainty, and as he nears the end of his efforts, he continues to pray for help. "Lord, guide me in everything," he wrote Thursday on Facebook. "I don't know what to do." Now let's go on to the article. Experts say newspaper raid broke law. Former prosecutor says police could have civil criminal liability. A central Kansas police chief was not only on legally shaky ground when he ordered the raid of a weekly newspaper, experts say, but it may have been a criminal violation of civil rights, a former federal prosecutor added, saying, "I'd probably have the FBI starting to look." Some legal experts believe the August 11th raid on the Marion County Records Office and the home of its publisher violated a federal privacy law that protects journalists from having their newsrooms searched. Some believe it violated a Kansas law that makes it more difficult to force reporters and editors to disclose their sources or unpublished materials. Part of the debate centers around Marion Police Chief Gideon Cody's reasons for the raid. A warrant suggested police were looking for evidence that the records staff broke state laws against identity theft and computer crimes while verifying information about a local restaurant owner. But police also seized the computer tower and personal cell phone belongings to a reporter who investigated Cody's background. The raid brought international attention to the newspaper and the small town of 1900 and a debate over press freedoms. It also forced an intense spotlight on Cody in his third month on the job. The investigation into whether the newspaper broke state law continues, now led by Kansas Bureau of Investigation. State Attorney General Chris Kobach said that he doesn't see the KBI's role as investigating the police conduct, and that prompted some to question whether the federal government would get involved. Spokesperson for the FBI and the U.S. Department of Justice declined to comment. Stephen McAllister, a U.S. attorney for Kansas during former President Donald Trump's administration, said the raid opened Cody, the city, and others to lawsuits for alleged civil rights violations. He added, "We also have some exposure to federal criminal prosecution. I would be surprised if they are not already looking at this. If they haven't already been asked by various interests to look at it. And I would think that they would take it seriously," McAllister, a University of Kansas law professor, who also served as the state solicitor general, said of federal officials. Cody did not respond to emails seeking comment. He defended the raid in a Facebook post saying federal law shielding journalists from newsroom searches makes an exception specifically for when there is reason to believe the journalist is taking part in the underlying wrongdoing. Police seized computers, personal cell phones, and a router from the newspaper. All items were released on Wednesday to a computer forensic auditing firm hired by the newspaper's attorney, after the local prosecutor concluded that there wasn't enough evidence to justify their seizure. The firm is examining whether the files were accessed or copied. The Record is known for its aggressive coverage of local politics and its community. It received support from other news organizations and media groups after the raid, and editor and publisher Eric Meyer said Friday it picked up 4,000 additional subscribers, though many of the new subscriptions are digital. Still, the raid has some backers in town. Jared Smith blames the newspaper's coverage for the demise of his wife's day spa business and believes the newspaper is too negative. "I would love to see the paper go down," he said. Carrie Newell, whose allegations that the newspaper violated her privacy have been cited as a reason for the raid, said of the paper, "They do twist and contort, misquote individuals in our community all the time." Meyer rejects criticism of his newspaper's reporting and said that the critics are upset because of its attempting to hold local officials accountable. He blames the stress from the raid for August 12th death of his mother, Joan Meyer, 98, the paper's co-owner. Meyer said that after the mayor offered Cody the police chief's job, the newspaper received an anonymous tips about why Cody gave up a Kansas City position paying $115,000 a year to take up a job paying $60,000 a year, according to a sister paper. Meyer said that the newspaper could not verify the tips to its satisfaction. Days before Cody was sworn in as chief, on May 30th, Meyer said that he asked Cody directly about the tips he received, and Cody told him, "If you print that, I will sue you." "We get confidential things from people all the time, and we check them out," said Doug Anistet, a retired Kansas Press Association executive director. "And sometimes we know they're silly, but most of the time we get a tip, we check it out. And that's exactly what they're doing." Anistet said that he believes the state's shield law for journalists enacted in 2010 by the Republican-controlled legislature should have protected the paper. It allows law enforcement agencies to seek subpoenas to obtain confidential information from news organizations, but requires them to show they have a compelling interest but can't obtain it another way. Former Kansas attorney, General Derek Schmidt, a Republican who helped write the Shield Law as a state senator, said it doesn't get contemplate law enforcement using a search warrant to get information without going to the court to get a subpoena. Still, he said, the spirit of the law is that it should be broadly applied. Now on to a more international article. Missile hits city center, 7 dead, over 100 hurt. Zelensky visits NATO candidate Sweden. A Russian missile attack in the center of northern Ukrainian city on Saturday killed 7 people and wounded over 100 others, including children, Ukrainian officials said. The attack in Chernihiv happened as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky arrived in Sweden on his first foreign trip since attending a NATO summit in Lithuania last month. Images of the aftermath showed how badly damaged buildings, including a theater with its roof blown away, mangled cars, and survivors walking in debris with bloody clothes. The dead in the daytime strike included a 6-year-old girl, while 15 children were among the 129 wounded, Ukraine's Interior Minister Ihor Klimenko said. The square in front of their building, of the theater building, has been bustling with life, with people returning from church after celebrating the apple feast of the Savior religious holiday, baskets of consecrated apples in hand, Klimenko said. Following the strike, debris from the theater littered the square, along with shattered glass from windows nearby cars and restaurants. The strike hit the theater during a gathering of drone manufacturers and aerial reconnaissance training schools, organizer Maria Berlinska confirmed. She said the event was officially agreed to in advance with both the local authorities and the venue. The city council denied it approved the event or issued permits. Zelensky said the attack showed Russia was a terrorist state and that the world must unite against it. A Russian missile hit right in the center of the city, in our Chernihiv, he wrote on Telegram. A square, the Polytechnic University, a theater, an ordinary Saturday which Russia turned into a day of pain and loss. Chernihiv was surrounded by Russian forces at the start of the war, but they withdrew after Ukrainian forces retook control of areas north of Kiev last year. Zelensky arrived in Sweden on an unannounced visit Saturday, his first to the Scandinavian country since the start of the full-scale invasion. The war prompted Sweden to abandon its long-standing policy of military non-alignment to support Ukraine with weapons and apply for NATO membership, though it is still waiting to join the alliance. Zelensky and Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson announced the two countries agreed to cooperate on the production, training, and servicing of Swedish CV-90 infantry fighting vehicles. Zelensky said Ukraine would start manufacturing the vehicles as part of the deal. He also encouraged Kristersson to share Sweden Gripen fighter aircraft with Ukraine. Sweden said it will allow Ukrainian pilots to test Gripen planes, but so far ruled out giving any to Kiev. In Russia, President Vladimir Putin visited top military officials in the city of Rostov-on-Don near Ukrainian border. The Kremlin said Putin listened to reports from the border from the commander in charge of Moscow's operations in Ukraine and their top military brass. Now on to another article. Delegation meets junta leader. Military chief claims civilian rule will be restored within 3 years. The leader of munitions soldiers who ousted Niger's democratically elected president said Saturday night that they will return to the country to civilian rule within 3 years. General Abdurrahme Tchadi gave no details on the plan, saying on state television that the principles for transition would be decided within 30 days at a dialogue to be hosted by the junta. I am convinced that we will work together to find a way out of the crisis in the interests of all, Tchadi said, commenting after his first meeting with a regional delegation seeking to resolve the West African nation's crisis. The delegation from the ECOWAS bloc, headed by former Nigerian head of state, Senator Abdusalami Abubakar, also met separately with toppled President Mohamed Bazoum and joined reconciliation efforts by Leonardo Santos Simoa, the UN Special Representative for West Africa and the Sahel, who arrived Friday. The soldiers who overthrew Batsoum last month quickly entrenched themselves in power, rebuffed most dialogue efforts in kept Batsum, his wife, and son under house arrest in the capital. ECOWAS, on August 10th, ordered the deployment of a standby force to restore constitutional rule in Niger. On Friday, the ECOWAS Commissioner for Peace and Security, Abdel Fattou Moussa, said 11 of its 15 member states agreed to commit troops to military intervention, saying that they were ready to go. The 11 member states that agreed to intervene militarily don't include the bloc's three other countries under military rule, following coups in Guinea, Mali, and Burkina Faso. The latter two warned that they would consider an intervention in Niger as an act of war. On Friday, Niger's state television said Mali and Burkina Faso dispatched warplanes in a show of solidarity. After the coup, the bloc gave the junta 7 days to release and restore Batsum, a deadline that came and went with no action. The junta leaders are cementing their rule and appointing loyal commanders to key units, while ECOWAS has no experience with military action in hostile territory and would have no local support if it tried to intervene, said Yulf Lasig, the head of the Sahel program at the Conrad and Endure Foundation, a think tank. Niger is a very fragile country that can easily turn, in case of a military intervention, into a failed state like Sudan, Lasing said. Also on Saturday, the new U.S. ambassador to Niger, Kathleen Fitzgibbon, arrived in the capital, said Matthew Miller, spokesman for the State Department. The U.S. hasn't had an ambassador in the country for nearly 2 years. Fitzgibbon will be focusing on advocating for a diplomatic solution that preserves the constitutional order in Niger and for the immediate release of Batsum, his family, and all those unlawfully detained, Miller said. Her arrival does not reflect a change in U.S. policy position, he said. Many residents said that they were preparing to fight back against an ECOWAS military intervention. Thousands of people in the capital of Niamey lined up Saturday outside of the main stadium to register as fighters and volunteers to help with other needs in case the junta requires support. Now let's move on to another article. Hurricane Hillary downgraded to Category 2 storm. U.S. Southwest braces evacuation ordered in some areas of California. Hurricane Hillary roared towards Mexico's Baja California Peninsula late Saturday as a downgraded but still dangerous Category 2 hurricane, likely to bring catastrophic flooding to the region and cross into the southwestern U.S. as a tropical storm. Meteorologists warned that the storm remained treacherous. One person drowned Saturday in the Mexican town of Santa Rosalia on the peninsula's eastern coast when a vehicle was swept away in an overflowing stream. Rescue workers managed to save four other people, said Edith Aguilar Villavicino, mayor of the Mulegi Township. It was not immediately clear whether officials considered the fatality related to the hurricane. Forecasters said the storm was still expected to be the first tropical storm to hit Southern California in 84 years, bringing flash floods, mudslides, isolated tornadoes, high winds, and widespread power outages. California Governor Gavin Newsom proclaimed a state of emergency, and officials urged people to finish precautions before sundown Saturday. It'd be too late Sunday, one expert said. Hillary brought heavy rain and flooding to Mexico and the southwestern U.S. on Saturday, ahead of the storm's expected Sunday border crossing. Forecasters warned it could dump up to 10 inches, a year's worth of rain, for some areas in Southern California and Southern Nevada. The San Bernardino County Sheriff issued evacuation warnings for several mountains and foothill communities. Now on to an article in Canada. Firefighters battle Canadian blazes. Firefighters battling wildfires in Western Canada received help from reinforcements and milder weather Saturday after the nation's worst fire season on record destroyed structures, fouled the air with thick smoke, and prompted evacuation orders for tens of thousands of residents. Flames were held at bay 9 miles from Yellowknife, the capital of the Northwest Territories, and weary firefighters had a reprieve around Kelowna in British Columbia. But the firefighters were nowhere close to declaring victory, especially with drier and windier weather forecast in the coming days. All of British Columbia was under a state of emergency Saturday. About 35,000 people were ordered to evacuate wildfire zones across the province, and another 30,000 people were under an evacuation alert. And now on to heat wave bakes the U.S. Southwest. The summer of 2023 may be drawing to a close, but the extreme heat is not. More record-shattering temperatures, this time across Texas, were expected Saturday and Sunday as the U.S. continues to bake. Highs in the 110 degrees Fahrenheit forecast for Saturday and 110 Fahrenheit on Sunday in Dallas would break the record of 107 Fahrenheit each day set in 2011, National Weather Service meteorologist Tom Bradshaw said. There really is no relief in sight. There is some hint by the end of August, maybe Labor Day, high temperatures will begin to fall below 100, he said. It's possible to see 100-degree-plus temperatures through the first half of September, at least off and on. An excessive heat warning was in place from South Texas, western Louisiana, across eastern Oklahoma, eastern Kansas, all of Missouri, parts of Arkansas, Kentucky, Minnesota, Nebraska, Illinois, and Iowa. Now let's move on to a much more local article. Decadent Delight dubbed new favorite at State Fair. Deep-fried bacon, brisket, mac and cheese, grilled cheese wins new best food award. The team behind the Iowa State Fair's Best New Food begins work before most fairgoers are awake, preparing macaroni and cheese and other components by 6 a.m. each day. The deep-fried bacon brisket mac and cheese grilled cheese, a gooey, crispy, dense bomb of flavor from What's Your Chez, won the Best New Food Award at the State Fair Wednesday. Joni Bell, the owner of What's Your Chez and the creator of the new dish, declined to take credit for winning the award. "It's not all about me," she said. "It's all about our team here that makes this thing happen. There's a lot of work that goes into this." Here's a subheader that says, "What goes into the sandwich?" Tony Jurero, who runs the Rib Shack, a stand nearby that Bell also owns, begins by cooking up the mac and cheese at 6 a.m. "The stand will go through as many as 160 pans in a day," Bell said. Then, the fresh-baked bread from Urbandale's Big Sky Bakery is brought in. The stand's employees build sandwiches right away, and they go into the fryer at 9:30 a.m. The vendor sold 14,000 sandwiches at $12 each as of Wednesday. More than 8,000 people voted from three options to crown the winner, and 47% of votes were for the deep-fried sandwich. The other options were the Iowa Twinkie from Whatcha Smokin' Barbecue and Brew, a bacon-wrapped stuffed jalapeno pepper, and the Grinder Ball, a blend of bacon balls and mozzarella cheese wrapped in bacon. Another subheader, Sandwich Creator is back-to-back champ. This isn't Bell's first time taking the top prize at the Iowa State Fair. She won the same honor last year for The Finisher, a loaded baked potato sold at the Rib Shack. And she's won the award two other times over her 12 years cooking greasy favorites at the fair. The Rib Shack has been selling a bacon brisket mac and cheese dish for years. The innovation this year was putting it on bread and tossing it in a deep fryer. The inspiration for that, Bell said, was spaghetti sandwiches she ate as a child. "We had to eat that because we were poor," she said, "so we had spaghetti sandwiches on the farm." When coming up with a new food, Bell said that she likes to try to think about what people like and use quality ingredients. The dish uses AE milk and creamy, generous cuts of brisket and loads of white and yellow American cheese. What do people like? Well, they love bacon, they love brisket, and I know everybody loves mac and cheese, she said. The sandwich is served with a raspberry chipotle sauce, which Bell said elevates the flavor. The vendor has been busy throughout the fair, but Bell says she expects business to get even busier after winning the top honor. A line stretched far down the sidewalk after the award was announced on Wednesday. We've been swamped the whole fair, and of course this will make it busier than normal, Bell said. So you have to put your mind to what's going to happen next. Ashley Smith of Ottumwa was one of the thousands of fairgoers to enjoy the sandwich. It was the first thing that she had at the fair, and she gave it a glowing review. It has brisket in it. It's fried. It's definitely filling, she said. I definitely could have probably ate one side and not both of them, but it's great. Very good. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, August 20th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries, starting with Karen Sue Kloster. Karen Sue Kloster passed away on August 7th at Ravenwood Care Facility. She was born July 3rd, 1939, to Austin and Fern Sheely. She graduated from East High School in 1957. Karen worked at Bishop's Cafeteria, retiring when they closed. She married John Kloster on August 21st, 1972. She is preceded in death by her husband, grandson Chris McCulley, her parents, and two sisters. She is survived by her daughter Erin McCulley, grandson Preston, brother Michael Shelley, and sister Sue Furman. Graveside memorial services will be held September 16th at 1 at Garden of Memories, Waterloo. Jerry Allen Brown, Bolton, 73, of Jessup, Iowa, passed away after a 10-month battle with T-cell lymphoma. On Friday, August 11th, at home with his wife by his side. A celebration of life will be held at 1 p.m. on September 9th, 2023, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Central City, Iowa. For a full obituary of Jerry, visit www.murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Howard A. Webrand. Howard A. Webrand, 65, died on August 17th, 2023, at the Cedar Valley Hospice Home in Waterloo. He was born on March 20th, 1958, in Cedar Falls, the son of Orlo and Ethan Tootie Webrand. He graduated from Cedar Falls High School in 1976. He was employed as an engineer with the Illinois Central Railroad for 35 years before his retirement. He will be sadly missed, but will forever be in our hearts. Howie is survived by his father, three sisters, Vicki Baldwin, Barb Webrand, and Jolene Wilder, his caregiver and friend, Kathy Bruce, and her granddaughter, Ellie, his dog, Angus, and many nieces and nephews and friends. He was preceded in death by his mother, brother Wayne, and fraternal and maternal grandparents. Interment will be at the Greenwood Cemetery in Cedar Falls at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the Cedar Valley Hospice. Online condolences can be left at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. Now let's turn over to the sports section, starting with some Women's World Cup. The article, Sweden Earns Fourth Bronze Medal. Nobody beats Sweden on the rebound from a Women's World Cup semifinal loss, not even the tournament hosts. The Swedish women extended their perfect record in World Cup third place matches to 4, with Fridolina Rolfö and Kosova Aseli scoring Saturday in a clinical 2-0 win over Australia. It feels amazing. We showed from minute one we were the better team, Rolfö said. We deserve this medal. It was a disappointing finish for the Matildas, who captivated their country during their run to the semifinals for the first time. The tournament, co-hosted by Australia and New Zealand, has set the attendance record, and two of Australia's matches became the most watched programs on domestic commercial TV in 20 years. With the Sydney Opera House lit up in the green and gold colors of Australia, and supporters flocking to fan zones to watch on giant screens across the country, there was still hope of some kind of medal for the Matildas. Ultimately, it ended with back-to-back losses to number 3 and number 4 ranked teams in the world, even with star striker Sam Kerr backing the lineup, the starting lineup. "We wanted to win. We wanted to have some hardware to take home. Wasn't to be," Kerr said, "but the way the fans have got behind us, the way the girls have carried themselves, I think we've proven to the world that we are an amazing footballing, that we are a footballing nation. We couldn't get it done tonight, but hopefully we've inspired people for many years to come." The Swedes won all three of their group games and then ousted the two-time defending champion U.S. team on penalties in the round of 16. They followed that up with a win over Japan in the quarterfinals. Staying compact and organized and exploiting holes in defense, Sweden was dominant for the most of the third place match. Rolfo converted from the penalty spot with a low curling left foot shot in the 30th minute after Australian defender Claire Hunt was penalized after a VAR reviewed for tripping up Stina Blackstenius. Azalina's well-timed strike to finish off a long-range Swedish counterattack in the 62nd minute sealed the victory. Goalkeeper Zarcia Musovic kept another clean sheet in an outstanding tournament for Sweden, blocking Kerr's angled right-footer strike in the first half stoppage time and stopping Claire Falkenhorn's shot from right in front of the 70th minute. Now on to some golf with Scheffler Fitzpatrick share lead at BMW Championship. Scotty Scheffler was feeling good about enough with his short game that he was willing to take on a long shot with high risk. Just like everything else Saturday, it worked out just fine for him in the BMW Championship. In wind that gusted through tree-lined Olympia Fields, Scheffler hit a driver off the fairway on par 5, 15th hole, that traveled 299 yards, a lot of it on the ground, just short of the green, to set up his 7th and final birdie in a round of 6-under-64. It gave him a share of the lead with Matt Fitzpatrick, who played a clean round until having to salvage a bogey on the final hole for a 66. "I haven't hit a driver off the deck as much as with this driver as I have drivers in the past," Scheffler said. "The shot is really shaped well for that kind of play. I tried it the first day because I thought it would be fun and I hit a pretty good shot. And then I did it again today because I thought it was fun. Equally fun was seeing so many putts go in, no matter the distance." Scheffler made 2 short birdie putts at the start and 1 putted the opening 5 holes. He wasn't hitting it in his best, and his bunker play in particular, along with making the putts, made all the difference. Scheffler and Fitzpatrick were at 11 under 199, one shot clear of the British Open champion Brian Harman, who had to settle for a 67. The top 10 players, all but 2 have won on the PGA Tour this year, are separated by 4 shots going into the final round. But that's not the only way to keep score in the final round. At stake for more than half a dozen players is making sure they finish in the top 30 in the FedEx Cup to advance to the Tour Championship next week at East Lake. Among those on the bubble is Jordan Spieth. At stake for a few Americans is trying to earn one of six automatic spots in the Ryder Cup with the BMW Championship as the final qualifying event. Strong finishes by the likes of Max Homa and Xander Schauffele could knock out the PGA champion and LIV golf player Brooks Koepka. The pleasant day south of Chicago illustrated chaos can happen at any time. Scheffler, with at least a share of the 54-hole lead for his first time since he won the Players' Championship 5 months ago, kept his stress to a minimum. He dropped only 1 shot at number 9 and responded with 3 straight birdies to start the back 9. Homa wasn't so fortunate. He seized control early, and while he was out of position on the 7th hole, it didn't look like a big problem until it was. It took two chips from right of the green to get within 15 feet and three putted missing from 2 feet to make a triple bogey. He missed two or more par putts from 15 feet and 8 feet on the back nine, but steadied himself, coming in and hold a 7-foot par putt on the final hole for a 71. It was definitely uncomfortable putting in that wind, Homa said. I had a long one on 18, and you're judging a big slope, and it's going to start running downwind and downhill. So it made it uncomfortable, but that's why this golf course is so good. He still was within two shots of the lead at 9 under 201. Rory McIlroy and Victor Hovland were three behind. McIlroy opened with four birdies in six holes when his round came to a halt, particularly on the 10th green, when he three-putted from 15 feet. Homa, meanwhile, now shares the North Course record with Sam Burns, who had eight birdies and a clean card for 62. That was valuable because it put Burns in the group at 7 under 203 and revived his chances of going to East Lake. He had opened with rounds of 71 and 70, not the ideal start for someone who came into Olympia Fields at number 30 in the FedEx Cup. The four-way tie for the seventh projects him inside the top 20, and now it's a matter of staying there. Back to another Women's World Cup article, building on success of Barcelona team. If those precise passes that untangle defenses and the attacks coming from all angles by first-time Women's World Cup finalist Spain looked familiar, there is good reason. The Spanish squad is built on a core of Barcelona players who have triumphed within their clubs and are now one step away from the ultimate prize when they face England on Sunday in Sydney. Nine Barcelona players, including two-time Ballon d'Or winner Alexa Putella, attacking midfielder Anita Bonmati and defensive leader Irina Paredes are among the key players for Spain. The club's influence also extends to the England team, which features Barcelona players Lucy Bronze and Kiera Walsh. Some of us are very lucky. We've won two Champions Leagues with Barcelona, Bonmati said after beating Sweden in the 2-1 semifinals. Barcelona's women's team has played in front of record crowds exceeding 90,000, Bonmati added, but playing at a World Cup final in front of 75,000, it'll be crazy. I can't believe it's going to happen. Am I in a dream? This surprising run by a generation of women who started their careers with few of the advantages of their male counterparts and has ended up on a similar path when it comes to taking Spain to the top. Just as Spain's 2010s World Cup champion team included seven Barcelona members and coincided with the club's best years, the rise of the national women's team comes after Barcelona's women established themselves as one of Europe's elite teams. Barcelona's women's team has reached four of the last five Champions League finals, winning two, including 3-2 comeback over Wolfsburg in June. It has also won four consecutive Spanish league titles. Now back to a more local article. MLB makes strides in attracting younger fans. Bryce Harper wants to get to Copperstown. Sure, what baseball player, especially a two-time NL MVP, such as Harper doesn't dream of induction into the Hall of Fame? But Harper's hope does extend well beyond a call to the Hall. The Philadelphia Phillies slugger would love for Major League Baseball to stick one of its yearly attraction games akin to the Field of Dreams and London trips in Copperstown, New York, as a part of the Hall of Fame weekend. I think it's pretty cool being able to play in different areas in different countries, Harper said. The next one we were all talking about would have been the Hall of Fame game. I grew up all talking about would be a Hall of Fame game. I grew up playing in Copperstown at the Copperstown Dreams Park. That was a travel ball place to go, kind of like Williamsport. It's a little bit different level than Williamsport, but it's pretty cool. Harper and the Phillies hit Williamsport, Pennsylvania on Sunday to play the Washington Nationals in the annual Major League Baseball Little League Classic at 2,366-seat historic Bowman Field. The field is just a six-mile trip from the complex where the Little League World Series is underway, with kids full of big league dreams, many of whom who will attend the game ready to mingle with today's stars, perhaps like Harper did, and find their way from one of their youth baseball's biggest summer stages to MLB. The classic and games like it are in part of MLB's outreach efforts to draw more fans, preferably ones closer in age to 21 years old, stars such as Jordan Walker and Ella De La Cruz. MLB says the efforts are working. Ticket buyers are younger, more teens are watching the games, yes, on old-fashioned TV. Social media accounts such as John Boy Media generate big traffic numbers with kids looking for snappy highlight breakdowns, and education on the game's great come-ons, a deep dive for a few hours playing MLB The Show. Baseball has boosted efforts to reverse declines in participation among the underprivileged communities and among young black players, and has vowed to diversify the game from the grassroots level to the highest level of team and league decision makers. The Hall of Famer Ken Griffey Jr. has served MLB as a youth ambassador and hosted Division I baseball players from HBCUs all around this season's All-Star Game. Other programs across the country aimed to increase and diversify the sport's reach, such as MLB Youth Academy Dream Series and Reviving Baseball in Inner Cities RBI program. Tony Regans, former scout and GM, has been tasked with bumping those numbers in his role as MLB's chief baseball development officer. He's pledged to build participation at all levels and has found some recent signs of growth encouraging. Once they have that connection and positive experience with the sport, the chances of them becoming a fan are greatly enhanced, he said. Baseball's biggest hits these days are the numbers found on TikTok and YouTube that have ballooned the sport to a wider audience. With kids these days holding the attention span of a home run trot, Major League Baseball introduced a slate of rules designed to speed up the pace of play, notably with the pitch clock. The average time of the game this season is 2 hours 38 minutes, trimmed from the 3 hours and 3 minutes last season and 3 hours and 10 minutes in 2021. MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred said the median age of ticket buyers this season has dipped to 43 years old, which is down from 46 and 49 years old in previous years. We've talked about a lot of younger audiences and how significant they are for the future of the game, Manfred said. That about covers most of the sports from today, but there are still a few other local articles, such as Lost Island Growing. Attendance increasing as Waterloo attraction adds rides in second year. Lost Island theme park attendance nearly doubled this summer from its first season, according to general manager Eric Birch. But the attraction is not yet profitable. Saturday and Sunday complete the last full week of operations this season for the park at 2600 East Challis Road. It is also open next weekend, August 26th and 27th, for Labor Day and Labor Day weekend, September 2nd through 4th. The positive word of mouth is getting out that we are open and it is worth the experience, so we are hoping to see a significant increase next year, Birch said in a telephone interview. Last year, the total attendance was far below Lost Island's projections, a tenth of what had been expected, reaching 26,425 guests, Birch said. As of Friday morning, with about a week left in the season, attendance had reached 46,000. The park was built to handle a peak day of 7,500 guests daily, what he considers wall-to-wall and shoulder-to-shoulder. The most popular day was last Sunday at 1,400 guests, when the longest wait for any ride was only 8 minutes, Birch said. If you haven't figured it out, it would be a mistake to miss out before we actually start having crowds, he said. We are hopeful that this is the last year where we have no lines and no wait for anything. You can do everything in the park multiple times in a day. He attributed the growth in visitors to great weather, as well as to a more aggressive marketing campaign. The park was able to include an opening date in radio campaigns, on billboards, in mailings, and on social media. Last year, Birch said advertising was very tepid due to uncertainty about when construction would wrap up and the park would be officially open. Now that rides are also part of the draw in the theme park's second season. The extremely popular Yuta Falls Flume Ride and Matugani Launch Coaster were open for the first time. They did not open last season because of a fire and supply chain issues. Time management issues have delayed the installation of a carousel, which Birch said would be the big new attraction in 3 years. Other attraction additions this summer were costumed characters making visitors feel like they're somewhere else. They'll greet visitors through Sunday. Additionally, staff was more prepared this year. Last year, construction workers were on site throughout the preseason training and until the day before the park opened, June 18th. Next year, more and more trees and shade are planned, as well as theming upgrades and improvement to elevate the visitor experience. The park's opening day is scheduled for May 25th, 2024, the Saturday of Memorial Day weekend. The Birch family built the 159-acre theme park for an estimated $100 million to bring world-class family entertainment to Iowa, providing a Disney or Universal-like experience to residents without having to spend thousands of dollars on plane tickets and hotels in another state. The idea was never that we were going to make the money back. We just want them, the theme park and neighboring Lost Island Water Park, to be able to survive on their own, he said. The water park opened in 2001 and has reached the point of profitability. Birch hopes more people who drive to the water park will take time to give the theme park a try. We had much more optimistic expectations based on the water park's reputation, and we were anticipating that the attendance at the theme park would at least match the water park. The carryover, or the popularity by association, really hadn't caught on like we had hoped, Birch said. We are hopeful that by next year, revenues are exceeding the theme park's operational expenditures, now that people realize that it is the same level of quality as the water park. There's a subheader that says, Rides for Everybody. One of the draws to the theme park is the options for rides. There's definitely something for everyone, said Mariana Hendricks of Cedar Rapids. It has the thrills of roller coasters, but it also has the rides for younger kids and older adults who can't handle as many roller coasters. Hendricks visited for the first time Thursday with work friend Ashley Culver of Cedar Rapids, who pointed out various themes that come up over the five realms of Lost Island: air, water, fire, earth, and spirit. The colors are phenomenal. It feels like Avatar: The Last Airbender type stuff, said Culver. The color schemes are very vibrant and bright. On top of the Ferris wheel, you can really see the different schemes. She had some criticisms. The park's open spaces result in a lot of walking between attractions. Culver wanted a physical map to avoid walking more than needed between attractions. Besides the rides, there is a lot to do at the park, from games to food. Jameson Pringle, 11, of Waukee, was eating a hot fudge ice cream with his sister Joey, 9, and reminiscing about their time at the Kooky Station bumper cars, with all the spinning, as well as other rides as part of their first trip to Lost Island before the school year starts. I'm surprised at the lack of crowds, said Jason Pringle, their father. The rides are fantastic, the coasters are actually legit, and with it not being in a heavily populated area, I wasn't expecting that. It's very comparable to Adventureland. The setup is great, the staff is really friendly, there are healthy food options, it isn't just chicken strips. Joey Pringle was a fan of the macaroni and cheese with fries. Jameson Pringle was a winner on the one of the many old school arcade games. He dominated Whack-A-Mole and walked away with a penguin plush toy. Their parents tagged along with the all-you-can-drink mug for $20. Also, catching their last chance at a summer fun were 10-year-old Madison Martinez and her twin brother Mason of Bettendorf. Madison liked the Skyborne ride, as she described it as going up into the air to extreme heights. Her mother, Annette, finished her description, noting it then had a big drop. "We are doing the theme park today and the water park tomorrow," Annette Martinez said. "We've noticed that there's a lot of roller coasters, but there's also ones on the smaller rides for those like our 10-year-old. I hope new people keep coming out so it can expand and stay open." Their father, Josh, also noted the easy parking. "The food stands and the restrooms all over the park are a plus, as well as the all-you-can-drink mug. The family's one critique was that it was a little pricey." And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, August 20th. I'm your reader, Willem Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.